From RTE Radio, I'm Niall O'Sheridan. This is Playback Daily.
And they kind of present themselves either like 1950s housewives, and they're very dolled up, and you know, they suggest that you should put on makeup and do your hair before your husband comes home, and don't pester him about the worries of the day because he's out working. Or they go full like Amish country.
Some of the buildings that we use now for patient care have been used since 1757, and they're not suitable for 21st century care.
Did they not know that by putting down a wrong date of birth, which didn't coincide with their passport?
Yeah.
They weren't going to get on the plane.
Coming up on this Democratic Friday edition of Playback Daily, the trad wife movement, wholesome or Handmaid's Tale? How one of Europe's busiest maternity hospitals copes with 8,500 births a year. And Club 15 to 17, booking a holiday when you're a minor means never having to say you're sorry. That's all on the way over the next hour of the radio catch-up show that yearns for the days of the trad broadcaster, when radio people were radio people. Let's begin the show today with Maura Duran, sitting in for Oliver Callan, musing on the Bridgertonification of Dublin. It's quite hard to say that. As stars Nicola Coughlan and Luke Newton swept into town to promote the second part of the third season, dropping on Netflix next week, I think.
Dublin turned into Bridgerton last night because Nicola Coughlan and her co-star Luke Newton were in town to talk about and step on the red carpet for the third series of Bridgerton. Now, I'm a huge Bridgerton fan. I watched the first series, which I absolutely loved. The second series, now the third series is all about Nicola and Luke and their romance. It's kind of, that is the kind of theme so far. But the third series was released in bits. Now, if you haven't watched Bridgerton, I would urge you to watch it, especially the first series, which was brilliant. You know, I mean, the costumes are amazing. The storyline's amazing. What I loved was classical music reimagined and remastered into pop pieces. And it was so weird because you're listening and watching Bridgerton and then you hear this piece of music and you're like, that sounds like something. And, you know, would it be a piece of Mozart or, you know, reimagined? And it really, really worked. Really worked brilliantly. Absolutely fabulous. And of course, then there was The Duke. I rest my case. The Duke was just unbelievable. So you have to go watch it. If you haven't seen it, watch the first series. I love it. I am looking forward now to the second part of the third series because they dropped it. They're sparing it now. They're keeping us kind of waiting, Netflix are, because they know Bridgerton is so huge. So I think the next part of the third series is dropping next week. But Nicola Coughlan is shining in it. She's absolutely amazing. Reading in the papers today as well, and she had the most brilliant interview with Vanity Fair a few weeks ago, which I read. I have to say, she's got this great northern kind of wit, dark humour, but she says she finds it really weird now because before she could just wander around. Of course, she was famous from Derry Girls, but she could go anywhere and nobody would know her. But now everyone knows her everywhere. She says sometimes you just want to go to the pub, buy milk, but generally people are nice, so friendly. But she finds it kind of unnerving a little bit, she was saying in that Vanity Fair interview, that everywhere she goes now, no matter where, it's somewhere like Asia, and people will come up to her talking about Bridgerton. It's huge. When the first series dropped, I think around the 3rd of June, 45 million people watched it in 3 days. Can you believe that? It actually pipped Baby Reindeer off the post. We were talking about Baby Reindeer here the other day and, you know, the whole, how mad it has become. And Netflix say that Baby Reindeer, it's all about the algorithm because people are into that type of thing right now. If you haven't watched it, I haven't watched it, but I've read loads about it. It is on my list. It's all about a woman who stalks a guy. Now, Martha, the real life Martha in, well, she said that this is who she is. The real life Martha in the Netflix show Baby Reindeer is now suing Netflix for $50 million. She lodged that lawsuit in California the other day because she says that she got loads of hate mail and everyone was talking about her on Reddit and all over TikTok and making videos about her. And she just said, really, this is it. You know, I am the person. I am the woman that's being portrayed, even though, you know, they're denying that she is. The makers of it are denying that she is, but she's suing them for $50 million.
If they made a series about a ruggedly handsome but somewhat off-kilter radio catch-up creator, let's call him Noel, could I maybe get $50 million out of them as well? I'll just leave that with legal for now. Anyway, it's a celeborama on Oliver Callan this morning. Here, Maura throws Dolly and Queen Bee at us.
Now, Dolly Parton is also in the news today. She is heading for Broadway in a musical based on her life. Now, she has boundless energy now. She's 78 years old, but she never seems to stop. She's just, I think she's kind of a woman for every generation. And also the fact that Beyoncé has kind of reimagined her song Jolene, which I definitely think that is her best song. That totally has brought her to a new generation as well. She's supposed to write new songs now for this Broadway show. So I don't know when it's going to, I think it's 2026 actually, it's going to land on Broadway. She's hoping that it's going to be fabulous. I mean, I would love to see it if she travels with it. Dolly is just amazing. But what she said about Beyoncé, because a lot of people would say, you know, you've taken my song, you've changed it up, you've written your own words. But she thought it was really bold what Beyoncé did. Now that's on her country album, of course. Now, I still think you cannot beat the original of the species.
Too much star power to handle. So the short Friday morning monologue must end here before we're all engulfed in a fiery conflagration of teeth brighter than the sun. On Thursday's Liveline, Joe Duffy heard from people who had booked holidays through loveholidays.ie and found that there was a problem with their flights or accommodation. This morning, Claire Byrne spoke to Paul Hackett, CEO of Click & Go Travel Agents, about the problems people are experiencing after one of Love Holiday's main business partners went insolvent.
So you're dealing with the fallout from this, are you?
Yes, and I have to say, we and Irish travel agents and members of the Irish Travel Agents Association seem to be dealing with this in the appropriate way and ensuring that the consumers have a great holiday and aren't being asked to double pay.
Yeah, because some people are arriving at the hotel check-in desk and they're being told to pay again for their accommodation or that their accommodation hasn't been booked and it's gone.
And that is what's happened. Like FTI are a very, very large company. They have over 200 subsidiaries. And it's those subsidiary companies that are impacting Irish consumers because travel agencies book through those accommodation providers to put the holiday together.
Okay.
But the reality is, you know, if you're staffed and you're resourced as a travel company, you should be able to deal with these things. The consumer's holiday is the ultimate protection. They should not be asked to pay again. If they're being asked to pay again, they need to contact their travel company. The travel company should be available and the travel company should be making the payment directly to the hotel. Mm-hmm. And that's what we have been doing in Click & Go. That's what other Irish Travel Agents Association members have been doing. But some people are not doing that because they're not geared to that level of customer service. But from a consumer protection point of view as well, consumers are very well protected. The Package Travel Directive protects consumers across all of Europe for these situations. So where consumers have been let down by their travel company, the Package Travel Directive is there to protect them. But a better protection is booking with the travel agent who is contactable, who is available, who has the customer service resources to look after the customer. And that's what does not seem to have happened in some cases.
And what should people do if they arrive at the hotel and they're asked to pay?
They should immediately contact their travel company. That's the number one. And the travel company should then pay. And that's what we have had. This week, when you travelled, that subsidiary collapsed. We have had people in the destination who have been approached by the hotelier and said, look, the company who has the reservation here is no longer trading. You need to pay us. The consumer contacts us because we're available 7 days a week, as are, you know, most members of the Irish Travel Agents Association. And they are then paying directly. Like, it's very easy. Get the hotel on the phone, give them a credit card, make a bank transfer. What I was hearing yesterday was that was not happening in the cases that were outlined on the Joe Duffy show yesterday.
So, yes, some people cannot get in touch with their travel operator or the entity that they booked their holiday through. And they're in a bind because they probably are going to have to hand over the cash if they can't make contact with that operator.
In all likelihood, yes. And, you know, that's what customer service is about. That's what booking with an Irish travel company is about. You know, having an Irish phone number and a .ie on your website does not mean that that company is accessible, answers the phone to you, provides good customer service and looks after you. You know, Irish consumers do need to focus more on who they're making the booking with. They should be booking with members of the Irish Travel Agents Association. We have an incredible code of conduct in terms of the customer service that we must deliver. And, you know, I was at an event last night talking to numerous of my colleagues in different companies. They're all working and resolving this. Our customers shouldn't even know about this. That's how it should be. But where companies rely on chatbots or where they don't have somebody at the end of the phone, like when you have a problem on your holiday, you need to be able to pick up the phone, talk to a real person, get them to listen and get them to resolve the problem.
Well, that's the
and
whole that's point of booking through exactly. through a travel agent or a tour operator,
exactly.
isn't it?
And, you know, that's why, you know, consumers should go to the ITA website, look at who the members are. They should go to the Irish Aviation Authority website and look at, you know, the protection piece that's there. How am I protected? Is that company licensed in Ireland? If you have an Irish registered company, they're licensed in Ireland. They have a presence in Ireland. You know where they are. You know, if they don't have a license, they may have financial protection, but that doesn't mean they're going to look after you when a situation like this happens.
So people who are booked to travel this weekend now, should they just be double checking that everything is paid for, above board, signed, sealed, delivered?
They should take it that, you know, reputable travel companies are going to look after them. There should be no issues with them in terms of arriving at accommodation and having accommodation cancelled. If that happens, they need to contact the travel company right away and get that resolved. But from our consumer side of things, we have dealt with any bookings that were cancelled by the subsidiary collapse. So our consumers are not going to have a problem. Our TAA member clients are not going to have a problem. So from that point of view, I think if you're booked with an Irish Travel Agent Association member, if you're booked with an Irish licensed travel entity, your holiday should go as planned.
Mm-hmm.
If you're not, you really do need to speak to that company, get hold of that company. And that's where the challenge is. They may have a .ie on the website and they may have an Irish phone number, but they're not answering the phone.
That's Paul Hackett, CEO of Click & Go Travel Agents, talking to Claire Byrne this morning about the problems being experienced by some holiday makers this summer. Catherine Thomas, sitting in for Ray Darcy, welcomed comedian Kevin McGarren into studio this afternoon, and the conversation started with Catherine wondering if Kevin was the keen cook that her notes suggested he was.
For years, I just didn't bother.
Okay.
Like, throughout my 20s, if you had just like given me a tube to just plug into my stomach, I'd be happy with that.
Right.
But then lockdown, I think it was Gordon Ramsay, like watching Hotel Hell and stuff like that. I was like, I'm going to get into cooking.
Okay.
But I wasn't great. I remember like I was making a load of muffins for a family thing. I wanted to show off my new skills. And I mistook teaspoon for tablespoon.
Oh dear.
And I put a massive amount of baking soda into this mix and it just like basically exploded the oven full of awful muck. Well, so no more bacon. Bacon's too hard. Cooking's not that bad.
Well, I'm the same. I love to cook.
Yeah.
I've kind of gotten better over the years. I think with kids as well, you sort of find yourself doing a little bit more, maybe out of guilt.
Yeah.
You're kind of trying to give good food.
Do you follow recipes or are you like a jazz cooker?
I am a bit of both. If I'm doing weekend cooking, I do like to have the cookbook. I do like the sort of the whole opening it up and picking something to cook for family. I do like that. But during the week, it's just lash everything in, whatever.
My wife is very much like free-flowing. Whereas I like to follow instructions. But I hate, especially on American websites where you look up like recipes and the first three paragraphs are like, when I was a child, I went to Kentucky with my grandma and she would tell me stories about a beet farm and I was like, get to the recipe, just skip.
I have 15 minutes here.
I don't want to read a story about your granny. I want to just get to the instructions, please.
So Anna was there talking about a cod curry.
Yes.
For a Friday for our listeners to try. If you were to suggest a Kevin McGahern recipe or a favourite dish, what's your go-to sort of Friday dinner?
I used to love...
I know you're on your way to Cork, so it's probably something in the forecourt of the...
yeah, it'll mostly be Supermax.
Yeah.
I used to love making like a big pot of like... I used to call it slop because it was the only real description for it. It was like chorizo, chicken, noodles, tomatoes. It sort of throw everything into a big pot.
Yeah.
Like not very appetizing to look at, but quite tasty.
Okay.
But now my wife does this thing, we call it like fancy cabbage and bacon, where it's like pasta with mascarpone cheese, what do you call it, really thin Italian ham?
Pancetta?
Pancetta. Yeah, cook that a little bit, get it nice and crispy. And then like broccoli or something like that. So it's kind of basically cabbage and bacon for Italians.
Yeah, I like that.
I love it.
I like that. I would go with that.
Yeah.
Come here, I said you're on your way to Cork today. What's going on? Are you gigging down there?
I'm in Collins in Cork tonight, yeah. So yeah, I'm gigging there at my new show, Shy Talker.
Yes.
You have to be careful saying it.
Yes, you do.
Yeah, I love Collins. It's lovely. It's nice and intimate and they're very, very nice to you and they treat you nice.
And I know you've been doing the festival circuit. You were doing the Cat's Laughs in
Kilkenny. Aye.
And when I was chatting to Anna there and she was talking about cooking for Doreena, you know, and how that sort of can kind of instill a little bit of fear. When you get to the Cat Laughs, right, and there's a whole load of comedians.
Yeah.
Is it more... You know, do you kind of feel you have to be more on your game because
yeah,
you're surrounded
definitely.
By...
Yeah, because you've got like legends. You've got like Dara O'Brien and David O'Doherty and all these big names kind of watching you and you really want to impress them.
Yeah,
like
yeah,
Des Bishop was emceeing the gig I was at and he was very positive after. So you feel like a school teacher giving you like a little star on your head.
Love it. And how's the tour going for you?
It's going great. Yeah. Like I do love... touring around the place and meeting people and going to various parts of our lovely country, you know?
Yeah.
It's a good life.
Come here, you have a new podcast that is out at the moment and I loved the description of it because it says, the lovely show promises to be an ill-informed, rambling bed of nonsense to accompany you on a long drive or a particularly difficult load of laundry, not suitable for children and barely appropriate for adults.
Yeah, I think that...
I want to listen to that.
I think that really nails it. I think I wrote that in the car.
it's with Justine Stafford as well.
Myself and Justine Stafford, who is an amazing comedian and an online star, really. So we just, I suppose we found ourselves at gigs sort of backstage, just kind of chatting a lot. And we tried to kind of recreate kind of that feeling of kind of backstage chats at a comedy club, you know. There's no real MO to it, really.
Yeah.
So it is a bit rambly, but we have a lot of fun.
And great that you're ahead of the curve.
Oh my God. Yeah, I'm, we think that podcasts are really going to take off in the next decade or so.
But no, but actually, the people in the podcast world will tell you that this is just, it's the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah.
How big that iceberg is, I have no idea.
I kind of thought that was insane. Somebody told me like a year ago, I was like, surely, you know, we've reached peak pod. And they were like, absolutely not. And it is like... it is a great way to connect with your audience. Like the game has changed. Like even you were talking with Taylor Swift, it's not good enough to just go and do gigs and hope that your audience will build. You need to connect with an audience. You need to be chatting to them every week.
Mm. And that's the platform to do it.
That is
so you guys, you're chatting about everything from exams to embarrassing things you've done over the years. Speaking of exams, I was just looking, Matt's paper one is currently on at the moment and maybe just even finishing up. Like, do you remember it? And then, Matt, do you know Matt's paper two was first thing on Monday morning? That's not a nice weekend.
I don't, like, I cannot. I think I blocked it out of my memory. Yeah. It was such a dark period. I do not envy people doing exams right now. I hated it so much.
So were you kind of, like, what were your subjects in school? Were you kind of good at art or?
I was good. Yeah, I was good at art. Like, I moved schools so I could study art. We had an amazing teacher in the school I went to. So that was kind of my main focus. Look, I knew I was never going to get into academics. I knew I wanted to do something creative. So like, I didn't really work that hard at the Leaving Cert, if I'm honest.
Okay.
I knew whatever I needed to do, did not care about points.
Yeah.
And that was true, thankfully.
What did you study at college?
I did animation.
Oh, okay.
So like, I wanted to do cartoons. I always loved cartoons. But after I started working... I did work experience in a small animation place. And then I started working at night in the International Bar. And there I saw stand-up comedy. And I was like, here's a way to tell funny stories with a lot less work. It doesn't like 10 minutes. 10 minutes in animation takes like 3 months, you know, if you're doing it by yourself.
But, you know, we were talking about cookbooks there, but like children's books have become so huge as well. Is that something that you've ever considered? Like you're a dad of two as well, aren't you?
So I got two kids at the moment. You definitely do get a sense of what works. Weirdly enough, what you enjoy is kind of what they enjoy.
Yeah.
Because I always thought it was very hard to write kids' books. But I think if you like a story, like at the moment with TV, we're gone off Peppa Pig. We're gone off Bluey. We're going to keep it Irish.
Right.
She loves, there's a show in Irish, RT Junior called, oh my God, Let's Find Out.
Okay.
It's like an educational science show. My daughter loves it. And I like her hearing Irish accents. I like her, like, you know, not coming back sounding like a little American child. I think that would break my heart.
Kevin McGahern there, telling Catherine Thomas how at least one of his children isn't breaking his heart. On this morning's Oliver Callan, Maura Duran spoke to Karen O'Connor about her debut novel, Meeting May. Karen told Maura about having a baby when still in her teens, having many professional skills and a variety of jobs before moving to the US, where she started writing the novel.
Meeting May is set in suburban Dublin, and it was written... I started in America, I finished it when I got back, but really, yeah, that sense of home compounds in your mind when you're not at home. So it definitely comes to the fore more. Everything stands out more. You remember streets.
That's
and
very
the people.
True. Yeah. Yeah, it's almost like you have to go to an Irish bar when you're somewhere else.
I know.
And listen to Kaylee music where you'd never do that at home, or you might never do that at home if you're not into it. And Meeting May. May is an older woman.
May.
She's
is,
an octogenarian.
She is. She's in her late 80s, but she's feisty and she's fun and she's playful. And she's wise. She's a wise woman. She's lived her life. She doesn't have a lot of family there to support her. And herself and Susan meet by chance.
Susan is your heroine.
Yeah. Yeah. Susan is in her late 30s, and they bump into each other. Well, Susan nearly runs her over at first, and then they meet again a few weeks later. And Susan kind of takes her under her wing a little. She sees May needs some help, and she decides that they should be the ones to give it. But they form a real friendship, and they trust each other, and then they tell each other their deepest, darkest secrets, and that's when it all kind of falls to pot a bit. And Susan,
without giving too much away, what is the main burden that Susan is carrying?
It's regret, guilt, shame, really. And then I suppose the main thing in the book is acceptance. You know, we all have things in our lives that need to be accepted, and we all need a really good friend to help us on that journey. And May
is
that.
The one. Yeah, it's reflective. And you said it's reflective of your own life, because in the book, Susan wants to have more children.
Yeah.
Even though she's married, she has two kids and everything's fine.
Yeah.
And that echoes your own life of what you call secondary infertility.
Yes. Yeah. It's a bit of it's a bit different. I mean, I had three children, and we hoped to have more. And we underwent fertility treatment. It didn't sadly work out for me, but I mean, it's that, you know, as a mom or as a woman, you have your children, but you feel there's room for more love to give, that you might want to share with another little person. And you kind of, it's hard to explain to people that aren't there, because they, you know, everyone understands the need for a woman to have a child, but then when they want to have another child or another child, it's a bit like, oh, you know, why do you want more? You have some. So it's hard to quantify, it's hard to explain, but it's real and it's there.
And did people have that attitude towards you in your life?
A bit. I really didn't share that, you know, and I didn't feel that I could share it. And I was a busy mom, and I did have two small girls and a teenager, but I still really felt the urge to have another child, and I did meet other people that felt the same. There was a bit of sure.
You know, have kids already.
Yeah.
Why do you want more?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Why do you want more? And then you do, so you feel.
But it's a very personal thing. I mean, you can want what you want.
Exactly.
You're an individual, but still people were a bit,
Yeah, a little.
So it's an interesting take on infertility, because often when we talk about infertility, as you rightly said, there are people who, you know, are trying very hard to have one child.
Yeah.
And I mean, that is very profound.
It's huge.
And I suppose in one way you might understand if those people would look at someone like you as if you've completed your family.
Yes, yeah.
You know, but yet, I suppose, look, we all want what we want, and that's it. In the book as well, when you
think about a young woman and an older woman. We don't often have that type of friendship in society anymore in Ireland. I mean, the multi-generational living is something that's changed a lot. I mean, my grandmother lived with us. You know, my father's uncle moved in for a while because, you know, he had to. He was on his own. But it doesn't really happen anymore. People are busy. Everyone's working.
Yes.
So this might give a different take on that type of relationship to people.
Definitely. I feel that May represents maybe that older aunt that you have that you know you should visit but you don't really, or that neighbour that you see going up and down the road on her own and you never see her with anyone. And it's, you know, the older generation have a lot to give us and we learn a lot from them. And the crack can be mighty, you know. And I just wanted to give May a chance to shine, you know, as an older person
with wisdom.
Yeah. Yeah, and heaps of wisdom. Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
That's actually very true. I remember my mother saying to me that she didn't even begin to know herself until she was in her 40s. And another thing as well that she often says to me, which I think is so true, although we get older and we look different physically, our minds are the same. And our brains are always 25, really.
Yes, absolutely.
And maybe people don't realise that sometimes. Yeah. We don't realise anything. I mean, when you're 20, you think 40 is ancient.
You do. I know. My girls, you know, they slag me all the time and they refer to me as older or old or whatnot. You
know, change that narrative.
I know.
We have to change that narrative. We're talking about Dolly Parton, 78, off on a musical adventure again in Broadway.
Yeah.
So I think it's a mindset. Tell us then how you actually got to writing, because I know you said you had a few pieces published in Ireland's Own, but then when you went about getting this book published, you were rejected a couple of times.
Oh, lots of times. You know, I mean, writing has always been there for me. I always wrote diary. I was telling your researcher, Susan, that when I was 17, my best friend moved to France and we'd no mobile phones. There was no internet as such. So we wrote letters to each other.
We all did that, I think, in those times, really, and pen pals and all that.
Yeah.
But you had the book ready, so you went to the publisher and they were like, no.
No.
Why?
I sent out tons of submissions. You don't find out why. That's the heartbreaking thing.
Did they not tell you why?
Not really, no. The writing's good, but not for us, or just not for us at this time. Or actually, I see some potential here, but this is a tough market and, you know.
It's hard to know, though, how to improve then, isn't it?
It is.
Is that why you went to Maynooth and did the writing course?
Absolutely. So a few years floundering and meeting May was put back in the drawer and I started working on another book. And then I thought, well, you can't just keep writing them and putting them in a drawer. So I did
out of the drawer again.
Went to Maynooth to do the creative writing for publication course and just loved it. It was like finding your tribe.
That's Karen O'Connor talking to Maura about her debut novel, Meeting May. The book is published by Poolbeg Press and it'll be in all good bookshops, and maybe even a few evil ones as well, from the 15th of July. The Rotunda, I learned today, courtesy of Claire Byrne, is one of the busiest maternity hospitals, not just in Ireland, but in Northern Europe, with 8,500 births recorded last year. That number is expected to rise this year, so how will they cope? Professor Sean Daly, master of the Rotunda, joined Claire this morning to answer that question.
So you've big plans underway to cope with this increase in demand.
Yes, like for the first time, we've actually had more gynaecology referrals than obstetric referrals, you know, and that's a kind of new, I suppose, departure for us. The campus is expanding. The HSE, in fairness, have acquired two buildings for us behind the old Cleary's, the Earl Street building, which we have now named the Hampson House, or the Rotunda at Hampson House, to recognise the very important role that nurses and midwives provide for the women who come into the hospital. Miss Hampson was the first matron of the Rotunda, and we had a staff, I suppose, poll. We opened it up for people to make suggestions as to what the name should be. And then we picked the top four and then we polled, and Hampson came up
came top. So what will happen there?
So all paediatric and obstetric or pregnancy related outpatients will happen there. Mm-hmm. And we will knock down the old outpatient department and we will build a critical care wing, which will allow us deliver really 21st century neonatal and special care baby care, but also will expand our theatres. You know, we will close a theatre in that kind of reconfiguration and we will build a new theatre. So actually, we don't get any extra theatres, but they're now all on the same floor.
OK, so that will alleviate some of the pressure, will it, these developments?
It will. And then the HSE have also bought us 24,500 square foot on Dominic Street. So if you kind of come across Parnell Square and keep going, the Lewis comes round there, and that's Dominic Street. So we will move gynecology outpatients down there, our physiotherapy department down there, and our early pregnancy assessment unit down there.
Okay. So you mentioned at the beginning that your referrals now for gynecology have really increased. What's happening there? Why is that?
Well, I suppose a couple of things. You know, we would have had maybe 400 gynae referrals a month, let's say, 4 years ago. We now have almost 1,000. I think there's a couple of reasons for that. Obviously, the population's getting older. There's been a real focus on menopause and the management of menopause. And I think that that has resulted in a lot more women seeking care for that. And, you know, when we have over 4,000 patients on our waiting list, but we're managing it, I think, quite well. So there's nobody waiting more than a year. And we have four groups of patients waiting.
A year
more.
Is a long time.
I appreciate that. But there's nobody for general gynecology waiting more than 6 months. But we have four groups of patients waiting more than 9 months. And they are complex menopause, infertility, urogynecology, and then those women waiting for outpatient hysteroscopy. But we are putting on extra clinics. I think we're coping with that very well. And we really want to aim at the Sláinte care target, which is kind of 10 weeks, you know. Now, that will take a bit of work, but we're moving to, I suppose, a North Dublin Women's Health Initiative, so that we will manage all the gynaecology referrals across North Dublin with our colleagues in Beaumont and James Connolly Hospital. And it will all be centralised in the Rotunda. Mm-hmm. So,
well, maybe there is a move now in Ireland to become more like North America, where women would see gynaecologists on a much more regular basis. Do you think that that is at play?
I don't think so. You know, I think we're very lucky in Ireland in that we have a very good primary health care service. And our GP colleagues, you know, I met 8 of them 3 weeks ago. So we have a GP liaison group. 8 GPs who are interested in women's health came in at 6:30 of an evening outside of their normal working hours to discuss the service. We're going to try and build capacity within that group. You know, we're going to try and encourage people to come in and maybe train with us a little bit so that they can manage more easily, perhaps women with uterovaginal prolapse and things like that. So we're trying to build capacity within primary health care.
So then people won't need the referral.
Exactly, exactly. Mm-hmm.
And do you think that that is something that could be expanded and rolled out across GP services?
Yeah, I do. Certainly the GPs across North Dublin are very engaged with us. We have 2 GP evenings every year, one where they come in. And I suppose COVID meant that people couldn't come into the hospital. So we have one virtual evening and one evening where we come in and we provide kind of very nice food, I think. And we have a very informative evening.
Mm-hmm. Because I just gave that figure there, you know, 8,500 births across the year. That was last year, expected to rise in 2024.
Yeah.
I mean, is that you busting at the gills now? I mean, can you cope with that figure?
So when we deliver more than a baby an hour, which is 168 babies a week, that really does put the pressure on the beds, you know. And if we have no beds, then that affects our service across the whole hospital.
Mm-hmm.
So we're trying to increase our beds, increase our capacity. The board of the Rotunda have just bought 1, 2 and 5 Cavendish Row. So we're looking to move non-essential, and by non-essential I mean non-patient facing, not that they're not essential, but services across there to free up space within the hospital, because we desperately need more.
So
beds.
Admin moving out.
Admin, patient services will almost certainly move.
Yeah, because despite all of these new developments that you've told us about, the new buildings and so on, you're still operating in a very old building, aren't you?
We are, and we had a HICWA inspection there recently, and they commented on the fact that obviously some of the buildings that we use now for patient care have been used since 1757, and they're not suitable for 21st century care. And I think the new critical care wing that I mentioned earlier will mean that we will have more beds, but we really must. So if we look at, say, pregnancy-related care, Claire, we will have state-of-the-art outpatient facilities down behind Cleary's. We will have a beautiful 16-room bed delivery suite. And then postnatally, some women will go to 1757 accommodation, you know, and that's what we need to try and change. Yeah.
That's Professor Sean Daly, Master of the Rotunda, talking to Claire Byrne this morning about the plans for increasing capacity at one of the busiest maternity hospitals in Northern Europe. Now, as we heard on yesterday's Liveline and earlier on this programme, there have been a number of people who've had their holidays disrupted by problems with a supplier to loveholidays.ie. On this afternoon's Liveline, though, Joanna had another story about Love Holidays, but this time, well, it was a little out of the ordinary.
This story kind of started to unfold about 3 weeks ago, nearly a month ago now.
Okay.
Where a group of children, my child included, him and five of his friends, had in a giddy moment decided to book a holiday. Mm-hmm. Now, these are all children, all under 18, and they were lured in by the low prices and of Love Holiday. They stayed on course because of the easy access through the website, and they paid a deposit for a week-long holiday in the sun, basically. They did this without consent or knowledge of the parents. Mm-hmm. As far as they were concerned, that they would deal with that later on down the line when the situation kind of got, when the holiday got closer. So the holiday isn't booked it's in July. So they have plenty of time to work around their parents, I guess, in their head, in their simple way of thinking about it. The parents discovered that this was going on. Just the information was given to us in dribs and drabs from each of our children. When we decided to act on it, then I got in contact with Love Holiday. But we sat down and we analysed the information that the children had given them. So the booking is completely chaotic. The lead passenger, the email address, the home address and the bank account are all different individuals. And they were able to input that information on a booking. Mm-hmm. The date of birth that they gave the airlines was fake dates of birth, making them, obviously, according to whatever they're inputting, that making them legal to travel, but obviously they wouldn't be legal to travel. So I got on to contacting Love Holidays. Mm-hmm. So it started first off with phone calls to their Irish phone number. And I have to say at this point that the people on the telephone were very, very nice to deal with. Okay. And it would be unfair to depict them as being unprofessional.
So how many, just to go back, how many were in this group of under 18s who booked this holiday?
Six
many
of them.
Six of them. Okay.
Mine and five others.
Yours and five others. Did they intend to go on the holiday?
Oh, they did.
Okay,
they did.
Okay.
Yes, they did.
So they weren't play acting in that sense?
No, okay. They did.
And to put down, it was to put just down
immaturity and naivety, really, that they did. They expected they could go on this holiday.
So to put down the, to pay the deposit, how do they, like to pay?
So they needed a bank account, and they have a bank account. Among them, it's my son who has the bank account. We opened a bank account when I went down to the bank as legal guardian, and we opened a bank account together. He didn't enter into any kind of contract with the bank without consent of a parent, and we were able to do that. So he has a little job, and he gets his money paid into his bank account.
So when did you discover?
So that's where they were able to.
Okay, and as you say, this began to unfold a few weeks ago. But how did you find out about it if it's all in their name and they're doing it behind your back, so to speak?
So my child had said that he was going on a holiday with a friend of his, and then obviously he was saying that it was that his friend had made the booking, and I believe then that other parents were saying that our other children, the other parents were hearing that their friends had made the booking. That the children were kind of keeping the information back from us all. We were all kept in the dark.
And what age are they? They're under 18. What age are they? 17, 16 or 14?
16 and 17. 16 and 17.
Okay. And was this meant to be a post-leaving cert holiday or?
No. Not even. No. Okay.
And did they not know?
They were spoiling themselves.
Okay. Did they not know that by putting down a wrong date of birth, which didn't coincide with their passport.
Yeah.
They weren't going to get on the plane.
That's it. It shows the naivety and the immaturity and they're young. I won't hold it. You can't say anything about any of them. I would have done the same thing myself at their age. However, I would have had to go into a tourist office or travel agent with my passport. I wouldn't have gotten as far as these children were able to get with Love Holiday.
I understand. You know. Okay. Now, where are we now? Love Holidays took the deposit. Then you discovered they weren't acting the age. They couldn't go because they were given their everything. And so, Love Holidays. Where are we now with Love Holidays?
Okay, so what happened then was once I started making contact with Love Holiday, it started with a phone call, and I wasn't named as lead passenger, I had to make arrangements with the child and his parent to come and speak with Love Holiday and assign an adult as the person who would correspond for future correspondence, you know what I mean?
Okay, so, now let's follow the money. Yeah. How much money have been given to Love Holidays and how much do they want?
Okay, so there was a deposit of €174 taken off the children on booking.
Okay.
Then there is a total of 2,320, will be the total, but it's broken up into a schedule of 547 on the 8th of June and 547 on the 8th of July.
Yikes, the 8th of June is tomorrow. That's Joanna telling Joe Duffy on this afternoon's Liveline about how her underage son and some of his friends booked a holiday they can't afford to pay for on loveholidays.ie. Now, what sort of wife are you? Because there is, apparently, a trend onto socials that espouses the appeal of the traditional wife. What is a trad wife? Well, according to Wikipedia, it's just like it sounds. A woman who stays at home to raise children, cook, and generally look after her husband. Sounds like something a man came up with, doesn't it? Maura Duran asked author and journalist Ethna Shortall to talk to her about the phenomenon.
A trad wife is, well, so far, thankfully, it seems to be mainly an American trend. But they are women and they're posting on TikTok and also Instagram. And they believe in ultra-traditional gender roles, that the man's purpose is to go out and earn money for his family and the woman's purpose is to stay at home, keep a nice house and mind her kids. But it's not, we're not talking about stay-at-home mothers here. This is far more, and it's an ideology, and they generally do believe that the man is the head of the family and the head of the household, and that the woman should be subservient to him. They're generally very religious. They're evangelical Christians or Mormons, and they're kind of living. They're living, I guess, what looks like a simpler way of life, but, and they kind of present themselves either like 1950s housewives, and they're very dolled up, and you know, they suggest that you should put on makeup and do your hair before your husband comes home, and don't pester him about the worries of the day because he's out working. Or they go full like Amish country and they're wearing head to toe floral frumpy clothes and bonnets to match, and they're literally churning their own milk.
Yeah, they are. But, you know, I follow a few of them now. One is Esty Williams. You know, she's this blonde, and you talk about 1950s, very young. What I notice is that these women are really predominantly in their 20s. So she's this almost Marilyn Monroe lookalike. And she is saying all this stuff that you got to get up in the morning, do your beauty. And it's like, this morning I made scones, and I put 1 hour aside for my beauty routine, my nails. It's perfection.
Oh, I know. I fell down a hole for several hours last night, and I came across her as well. And one of my favourites of hers was this thing about how she was doing her makeup and she was saying, my husband's home soon and he likes my hair like this or whatever, and she was getting ready and someone in the comments was like, oh, I'd love to be able to do this, but it's hard when you have a toddler and you're pregnant. And she replied, she's like, yeah, I don't have kids yet myself, but I do know other moms that get up at 5 a.m. so that they can, you know, put on makeup and nice clothes. Blessings.
So it is kind of out there. Yeah, but there's another one of these trad wives, and her name is Nara Smith, and she's married to that Calvin Klein model Lucky Blue.
Lucky Blue, yeah, and he's a Mormon. His family are kind of, I think, quite strong Mormons. And they're married and they have 3 kids now. She's very young too. She's a bit of an outlier, I would say. She doesn't quite fit in. Like, her kitchen is very modern, very sleek. She's not white, and they're all, the rest of them, you know, generally they're very white. Like, you know,
she's South African, I think.
Yeah, she's South African and German, I think. Yeah, because she speaks German as well. I wonder if she is trolling us all, and that she is very knowingly doing what she's doing, because I just cannot believe it's real. And it kind of looks like a slick art house film, and that's what makes it so appealing, especially to young women. It's aspirational, but I wonder if she knows, because like, she has videos and she'll say, my kids wanted some cereal, so I set about making it from scratch. Like, making cereal from scratch, you know, embrace modernity and the good things this gave us, which is like a ready-made box of cornflakes, you know?
Yeah, well, it's funny because an awful lot now, in recent times, I've noticed that a lot of psychologists are writing about the dangers of this type of content online, and that it's, you know, showing younger women especially that this is what they should look like, or this is what they should aspire to, as you said, this aspirational, especially with Nara Smith, because she's so beautiful. She's kind of making like cookie dough, and I was violently wanting blueberry muffins. And so, as you said, with that monotone voice.
Yeah.
But I actually was talking to a few younger women recently who love her and follow her and want to be her.
I mean, I couldn't stop watching her. I can see like how you just, because she is beautiful, you want to look at her. And it does, it feels like a movie or something, but it's not real life. I mean, I think she has 3 children and she talks about feeding them, but they hardly ever feature in the video. She's making, like, her husband wanted to go out for a burger, so she made him it from scratch, including the bun. I think it took 3 hours. I'm like, you'd be on to your next meal. This makes no sense. And nobody that is also minding 3 children can spend 3 hours making a burger from scratch. Like, it is, you know, if I'm cooking and I have the kids there, it's like make the quickest thing, you know. A 3 hour meal is the kind of luxury, a luxury endeavor if maybe someone has taken the kids out for a few hours.
Yeah, it's true. Now, when you talk about these trad wives as well, there is a lot of men, of course, talking about this. Recently, that NFL player, what's his name? Kesley?
Harrison Butker, yeah.
Now, he came out very strongly. He was actually, he gave a speech there at a Catholic university, and he talked about the vocation of a homemaker and how his wife has basically decided that her life wasn't complete until she gave in to this and is a complete homemaker. Yeah, and he gave a speech to young women at this university.
Absolutely. Like, it was a conservative Catholic university, but like, even within that, I mean, these women
son have just put years into doing a degree. And he was saying, I mean, the speech in general was, you know, very right wing, and it talked about the tyranny of inclusivity.
Yeah.
But he was saying to those women, you know, some of you might go on and have careers, but, you know, he, like, I feel, I can't remember exactly what he said, but I feel sure that, like, you're mainly, you'll be looking forward to your real vocation, which will be being a wife and being a mother. And she's like, and he's saying how his wife's life didn't begin until she embraced her vocation of, you know, marrying him and having their children.
It's very funny, actually. His speech was kind of changed up by Katy Perry as well, then on Insta.
Oh, right.
Oh yeah, she did. She kind of put in and changed everything. Somebody got in touch with us. Their Handmaid's Tale comes to mind. Margaret Atwood has warned us. Do you think that this is dangerous?
Yeah, I think, I mean, you know, from my own position in Ireland, I'm watching it, and, you know, it doesn't have an effect on me. But they are huge on social media. They're not really selling themselves to people like me that, you know, are already out in the hustle, having kids, whatever. It's younger women. And they are saying things like, you know, don't believe that you need independence. They really advocate going straight from your parents' house to your husband's house. They question, do you need a degree? If you know for sure that you want to be a trad wife. I mean, education isn't just about getting a career. Even if you don't end up working, it is good to know things. Mm-hmm. And a lot of them, we fought for decades for choice, for female choice, and you're trying not to undo that. And you would worry that this kind of thing, to aspire to not really thinking for yourself, is not great.
Yeah, it doesn't sound too good, does it? Some people seem determined to make Gilead great again. Ethna Shortall there, telling Maura Duran about the trad wife phenomenon on Oliver Callan This Morning. Finally, on this edition of Playback Daily, nothing, Claire Byrne tells us, says summer like a freshly prepared salad. Claire got Chef Nevin Maguire in to talk us through the various leaves we should be choosing for our summer greens.
How do you feel about going into a supermarket and buying the bag of the pre-washed, ready-to-go salad leaves?
Do you know what? They're okay, but they don't tend to last, and you're kind of throwing them out. They don't, you know, they go off very quickly. I think a lot of people
fierce
grow
handy
their own
though, Nevin, aren't they?
Ah, they are. They are now. I mean, they are definitely convenient, but a lot of people are kind of growing their own. And I suppose we're lucky here in the restaurant. We're a full-time gardener, so he's kind of taught me a lot about different salad leaves that I didn't know about, even as a chef, what can grow, what can, and what. And I suppose they add so much colour, flavour, and texture to a salad. And we do eat differently during the summer. We eat lighter. We eat simpler, and we don't want to be kind of eating very heavy meals. So that's where salads really can make your food very exciting.
Mm-hmm. So in terms then of getting the salad leaves ready, first of all, because I know you want to start from the get-go here, because your big thing is making them last and having them ready to go in the fridge for when you need them.
Very good point. Yeah, I suppose the whole thing is to wash them really well. Invest in a little salad spinner so that doesn't bruise them, it doesn't damage them, it just rinses off excess water, because it's not good to have them too wet at the same time what we normally do. And even at home, I get some damp tissue and I wrap it kind of like when I wash the salad and spin it and put it into a little kind of airtight kind of Tupperware container, tissue paper on top and a little bit of cold water. And that's going to keep your salad fresh in the fridge for up to 5 to 6 days, which is perfect because they go off very quickly. It's warmer during the summer, they wilt. So a little bit of moisture, but not too much at the same time. And a salad spinner is really important because it removes, if you have too much water, it won't hold on to the vinaigrette or the salad dressing, whatever you're going to put onto it.
Okay, so spin them and then put them in the fridge on the damp piece of kitchen roll.
Exactly. And I mean, like if it's obviously, you know, you can use quite a bit of a kitchen roll and then you can wrap it. I remember working in different restaurants where we get full heads of salad leaves. We'd give them a quick rinse and we'd wrap the whole head so we wouldn't actually break them down. The likes of Baby Gem, because they're a kind of firm salad, but the likes of Rocket, like, they will wilt, so you need to definitely give them a good rinse, spin them out, and then damp tissue on top, and them in a container and just dress at the last minute. That's the key.
Okay, so no early dressing. So you get about 5 days out of your leaves then if you do that and keep them in the fridge.
Absolutely. I mean, as long as you don't have the fridge too cold and at the back of the fridge where sometimes maybe it's a little bit too cold and then get what we call freezer burn. Mm-hmm. So just be aware of that. Check them. And like exactly what you said, be prepared, be ready, because a beautiful salad that is already prepared and ready to go and just dressed at the last minute, that can just enhance any kind of meal.
Yeah, I mean, we had a bit of a salad last night and I look at it an hour after the meal and sure, it's gone, because the dressing, just as you said there, it destroys it really, doesn't it?
Yeah, I suppose it's the vinegar or the lemon, the acidity in that, it just breaks it down and it goes to mush. And that's why you can always have your salad dressing made ahead, which is gorgeous. If it's a lovely pesto or a nice balsamic, I tend to go for balsamic vinegar, but sherry vinegar is lovely, and red wine vinegar. There's so many options of vinegars out there, and a really good olive oil. And the rule of thumb usually is 3 parts oil, 1 part vinegar. That's usually it. You can put in mustard, whole grain Dijon, sweeten it with a little bit of honey. That's my sweet tooth coming through. But your dressing will keep, and it can keep for weeks and weeks, if not a month, easily in the fridge or an airtight container again. Mm-hmm.
But don't try to keep the salad for day two, because it doesn't work.
It doesn't. It doesn't. Have it all ready, as you said. Just whatever you're serving it, whether it's a nice barbecue or something like that, dress at the last minute and then just serve it. Because we'll go through some of the varieties, like butterhead, which is lovely even in a salad, but in a sandwich, that will wilt very quickly, go soft. Iceberg is a great one. It's quite a watery, it has a high water content, but it's a beautiful texture, even shredded over a burger bun mixed with some butter ranch kind of dressing, which is gorgeous. Baby gem. I love this. This is probably the one I eat a lot at home with a bit of rocket, to be truthful with you, Claire. And there's a lovely texture. It's crunchy, you know, and it can take on lots of lovely flavours, whether it's a Caesar dressing or a nice little balsamic. Them kind of newer ones, kind of called Carnival or Lollarossa, they look lovely and they are lovely, but they add a nice bit of texture, colour. So you eat with your eyes first. And then one of my favourites is rocket. And there's two varieties that we can grow very easily, the regular one and then a wild one. The wild one definitely is more peppery, and I love that over a kind of like a steak salad or a bit of grilled fish. It is just beautiful. Mm-hmm. I love that.
The gem lettuce and the iceberg, is there a big difference?
There is. I mean, the gem one is a tiny, small little leaves, and their bigger kind of brother or bigger sister variety is the romaine salad, used, of course, in Caesar salad. The baby gem is really versatile, because you could cut it in half, you could pan fry it with a little bit of oil, a little touch of butter, some lemon zest, and put that with some grilled lamb and a little bit of feta cheese over that, and you have a gorgeous side dish, instead of maybe doing broccoli or grilled vegetables, which just enhances a meal experience. I think they're both very different. The iceberg, as said, is a high water content, but great in a burger, and it kind of bulks up a salad. Probably that's the best way to describe it. And it keeps, it's a great salad to keep. So it'll keep much longer than a lot of them. The baby gem will keep definitely quite a long time once it's on the, you know, the little kind of root is on it, the wee end pieces of it.
Okay, you mentioned the romaine there. It's also called cass, isn't it? That's what they use in Caesar salad. And at home, they can't get enough of the Caesar salad at the moment. It's like a daily thing. But sure, look, I put it together the easy way. I know you'd recommend probably making the dressing from scratch, and I have to admit that's not what we're doing in our house, and I'm getting away with it. Is it an easy one to make?
Well, do you know what? You can get lots of lovely ready-made bought ones, which are lovely. Some of them have the anchovy, some of them don't. It actually is, and a great little thing is a little kind of stick blender that can emulsify it. So it's really like an emulsification. So it is. So there's eggs in there, a little touch of mustard, you know, anchovies can go in there, parmesan, which is a great cheese in a salad. And remember, if you get maybe a 24-month-old parmesan, because as it gets older, it gets lovely saltier, it's a lovely flavour, and that's one of the main ingredients, obviously, in a Caesar salad. So don't be afraid, you can get really nice Irish made ones that are gorgeous and really enhance it. Do you want chicken in your Caesar salad, a nice grilled breast chicken, or you can do little skewers, which is gorgeous, or you can serve it with actually some prawns, like a prawn Caesar salad, something a little bit different, mm-hmm. which is even lighter. Yeah, so you just mix it up.
Yum. That's Chef Nevin Maguire talking tasty summer salads with Claire Byrne this morning. And that's all I have for you on this edition of Playback Daily. The programme was compiled, written and edited by me, Neil O'Sheridan. Don't forget, you can listen back to all the programmes featured on Playback Daily on the RTE radio app. And the mothership, Playback itself, is on air and in podcast land every Saturday when Sinead has a smarter, sharper, shinier look back at the week in radio. But until the next time, from me, thank you for listening and good luck.